WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM and online WFMU.org. This is Radio Ravioli with me, Olivia, here every Monday, 3:01 until 6 p.m., playing a bunch of music. Well, no, that's not what I meant to say. Playing a bunch of new music. That's what I meant to say. Playing a bunch of new music that you probably won't hear many other places, especially on the radio, on the real broadcast FM. There's nothing like WFMU to inject some stuff that should be more popular, that everyone should be listening to, but sadly, they are not, and we have to show them the way. We just heard Earth Eater, a new song called Face in the Moon from the album Powders. We heard Leticia Sadier before that with New Moon. And Vanishing Twin started off the set with Lotus Eater. That's all for me. Thanks for listening. Keep listening to WFMU all month long. We got a bunch of fun stuff happening. Oh God, what is happening? There are dogs barking violently behind me. Thanks to Kalia Vandever for coming down for a live set earlier. Check out the archives if you missed it. And thanks to Richard James, who engineered the session and made it happen. If you didn't know, Richard is also doing fill-ins here at the station. I think he goes by Richard J when he's filling in, playing music for everyone. So check out his show and thank him for making it all happen. All right, bye. Have a good week, everybody. See you later.
Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour here on WFMU. Freeform Station of the Nation from Jersey City in the great state. I'm glad to be here and glad you're here. Really excited to feature a first on Tectonic. It only took 6 years and a couple weeks, but we are having a playwright as an interview guest. Max Friedlich joins us this evening. I interviewed him a few days ago, and we're going to play that interview as Max discusses his off-Broadway play called Job, which is playing right now at the Soho Playhouse, and it's really taking off. It's sold out. If you go to the website, which I've linked on the playlist, if you go to wfmu.org, click playlists and comments, you can find the link to the show, which is the URL is job at soho.co. Anyway, the upcoming performances are sold out, but Max is going to describe a couple of ways that you can still possibly get yourself in to see it when I play the interview. We're going to get to that in a second. First, I also want to acknowledge that we are in October, which is the month of our October fundraiser, the Hellraiser, the Heckraiser, whatever you want to call it. And as in past years, I'm going to say a little more later in the show about your ability to pledge to give to the station. But for the moment, before we go to the interview, I just want to say that during the month of October, WFMU celebrates the Hellraiser by putting on all sorts of different events in Monty Hall and out in Queens. And this is the big news. The WFMU Record Fair is back. We haven't had the full record fair for a while due to COVID and everything that's happened in the last few years. But it's coming back on Saturday and Sunday, October 14 and 15 in Queens. It's at a place called the Knockdown Center, which is on Flushing Avenue in Queens. And it's going to be 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. both Saturday and Sunday. And admission is all of $10. And you know those $10 help a lot to support WFMU. So hope you will come out to the record fair and help us celebrate October. Here we are in the fall, and it's a great time to support the station, as I will say more after the interview. So listen, let me tell you a little bit of context before we go into this interview with Max Friedlich. The reason that I was excited to have Max on, a playwright on, to talk about a play is because, as you'll learn, the play has something to do with tech culture, tech business. And it's so unusual for a play to discuss issues of ethics and treatment of workers and the difference in the generational perspectives on technology between millennials and boomers, skipping over a certain generation, which I'll get to in the interview. A lot of topics, in other words, that I've covered on the show are touched on or explored in this play called Job. And I thought it would be really interesting to share this interview with all of you, as, of course, we're not going to get into spoilers from the play, but you'll get a sense of what the play is about. And we talk about Max's background as well, which is fascinating. So why don't we go ahead and listen to my interview with playwright Max Friedlich here on Tectonic on WFMU. Max Friedlich, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you for having me. Big fan of the station.
Thanks so much. And I'm a fan of your new play called Job, which is running right now at the Soho Playhouse. I saw it last week, and really thought-provoking piece of work. And I know it's getting a lot of attention. So congrats on your success so far with Job.
Thank you so much. It's been really genuinely humbling and very surprising and very weird. So I'm really excited about all of it and excited to see what happens.
I said it was your play. Let's just establish, Max, you're the playwright of Job. And what I want to do is I want to talk about the play without giving any spoilers. So let's start with the basics. Job is a one-act play. It's set in a psychotherapist's office somewhere in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Correct.
And there are two actors on stage throughout the play, only two. Who are these two characters? And at least when the play starts, what do you want the audience to know is happening?
So the two characters, there is a older male psychotherapist who's sort of an old hippie type figure, like a longtime San Francisco Bay Area resident, sort of an old San Francisco boomer vibe. And then you, his character name is Lloyd, but that was just to like give I don't think you ever hear his name in the course of the play. And then there's Jane, who works for a massive tech company, who is in her late 20s and sort of represents a sort of more yuppie millennial ethos. The way the play is about Jane, who has had a mental breakdown largely as a result of working at this large tech company. And she has a breakdown at work, is the subject of a viral video. And then as a condition of her wanting to come back to work, she is mandated to go see this therapist. So that is the sort of basic setting of the play.
Right. And you're saying large tech company, and some of my listeners are going to want to know which large tech company, and do they mention it during the play? And we can just say, without giving any spoilers, the company is never named, but it's definitely one of the monopolies out there, one of the big tech monopolies. My guess is that it most closely resembles Google, although because of Jane's role there, which we can talk about, I suppose it could also be Facebook. But do you have, and I know you may not want to even answer, but do you have a particular tech company in mind?
I did when I initially wrote it. And then in the course of rehearsal, in the course of dramaturgical work of like trying to make sure that everything was accurate, we sort of leaned into the sort of parable nature of the play. And we sort of wanted the tech company to be an allegory for all tech. You know, we went down the different roads with different companies and we found ourselves being like, okay, like this is how this company works. This is how that company works. And like, we want to make sure we get it right. And then we were like, it's a play, it's fictional. The feelings resonate. This is the other, it's somewhat of a spoiler, but it's not sort of the major spoiler of the play is that Jane works as a content moderator, which is a job that exists across tech companies. So we wanted to let the audience know that, you know, it's not an attack on an individual company, more so a statement about the negative human consequences of certain kinds of tech labor across the industry and not just aimed at one company.
That's right. Although you could choose any one company and there'd be plenty to complain about that one company's behavior.
If anyone wants to come to the show and project whatever company onto it, I'm on board to be like, yeah, this is a statement against that company in particular. I'm totally down.
A few years ago, I had Sarah T. Roberts on Tectonic talking about her book Behind the Screen, talking about the exploitation of content moderators who very often do not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they that role, as I'm sure you know, Max, is often filled by people who do not live in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yes.
Sometimes they live in lower cost parts of the U.S., but most often they live in other countries, live and work in other countries where they are treated as third-party contractors and really disposable. Listeners can go back in the archives and listen to the whole thing about my thoughts and Sarah's thoughts about content moderation. But I thought it was really significant that here we have Job, a play that is, while the whole play is not about content moderation, Jane's role as a content moderator does play into the play. It's central
Definitely.
To the play.
Definitely.
One of the things that you mentioned a couple minutes ago is that she's in that office because she's had a mental breakdown. And I appreciated that. And we won't get into the details, which there are some details mentioned during the play, but just on a high level, you're helping to expose to people some of the mental health risks that come with a job of content moderation, in particular in tech.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the hope. The play emerged out of my own experience working in tech, which was a very circuitous, strange, backwards, accidental one, where I worked for this company called Brud that built fictional influencers, most notably an account called Lil Michaela, who I think now has over 2 million followers. But when I got hired, it was through... I had met someone professionally for writing, and they, I had made a fake Instagram as like a joke to sort of occupy my lonely brain in LA. And I showed it to this woman sort of randomly, and she was like, "Oh, you should meet at this company." I thought it was like an art project because we were like, you know, making these fake women and like having them try on cool clothes. And like sometimes like they'd be like hanging out with a real DJ, and you're like, "This is kind of cool." And then we did this big storyline. This sort of metafictional storyline about her origin story and revealing that there was a fictional story where this character was actually a robot. And through that, someone did some digging or it got leaked or whatever, and it turned out to be a Sequoia Capital-backed startup, which I had no idea. That was not disclosed to me when I started working there. And I began a year of working as a creative, in quotes, for this company, writing YouTube videos for them, writing captions and storylines and all this stuff. But a lot of what the job was sort of, for lack of a better term, like mainlining the internet and sort of keeping a pulse on what people were saying about the character, how people were interacting in the comments. And at one point I played two characters who were dating, and I would get, and then they broke up, and I would, on the male account, I would get a comment being like, "You're the worst, like you should kill yourself, you're awful." And then I would switch to the female account and I would get a comment from the same person being like, "Stay strong, queen, like I love you." And all of these millions of people were sort of responding to these characters, but it was coming to my phone in my apartment. And there was a day where we accidentally posted an unedited photo of one of the characters. So we used human models and we would composite, we'd essentially like animate onto them. And my coworker sent me an unedited photo. I didn't look at it, and I posted it. It was up for like 3 seconds. It was like this huge thing. And I had to spend, not being hyperbolic, legitimately 24 hours on the internet. I didn't sleep that night, just spamming comments of people being like, "We saw your real face, like you're exposed," whatever. And it's a very long-winded way of saying the play really came out of that one night of what it is to actually experience the total overload of the internet, A, for your job, for your profession, B, for something that categorically I bear the company no real ill will, but, you know, in terms of the larger world, doesn't really matter, you know, that I was chiseling my mental health to a bit. Because why? Because we didn't want people to talk about how these weren't actual robots. Like, of course they're not. So it was a very strange time. And I became obsessed with the tech mindset and how the company was pitched. And we talked so frequently. I'll retract that. I bear them a little ill will just because I think it's kind of stupid. But, you know, we talked frequently about how we were helping people and how these characters could be forces for good and they could represent all these social causes. And it came to a head one day when our CEO gave the sort of investor pitch, like the thing that he said to people to raise money. And it started with him going, "Jesus, Muhammad, who are these, if not like the original influencers?" And I was just dying laughing. And I think it, yeah, I was just, I became super interested in this sort of modern conceptualization of labor that I think really begins in the tech sector, where you have to be helping people, and what you're doing has to have, you know, be objectively good, rather than just like, "Hey, we're making these goofy characters because like we want to make money and like we want to tell a cool story," which I think is like totally valid. But it had to be like, you know, we're gonna make these like social justice influencers who are gonna change the world.
That's a fascinating story, I have to say. So Lil Michaela, was it Lil Michaela and her boyfriend that broke up? Was it that?
No, character? It was Bermuda is Bay was one of the other characters. And then Blocko 22, who was my baby. I loved that character. And they dated and then broke up.
So Job comes off of that 24-hour period of your essentially being the content moderator. You're fielding all of the emails and online comments that came off of that just that 3-second exposure
exactly.
of the model's face. So did the people who were posting comments and sending emails, did they understand that these were just for kicks, you know, that these are just characters, or were they somehow projecting real people in a real relationship? How seriously were they taking?
It's a great question. I think that job sort of showed me the limits of like scaling interesting storytelling on the internet, at least in like a digitally native format, because we talk about like levels. We talked about game theory a lot and like the levels of engagement and like the kinds of players that we were. Someone is going to obliterate me in your comments or whatever, but I know in like game theory, sometimes there's like the notion of like the ruiner, or someone who is like sort of bought into the world of something, but is also in it to like mess up the experience for other people. So we had some people who were sort of cosplaying along, who were like, I don't care that you're a robot, you're whatever, you know, who knows, those might've been 10-year-olds who thought it was real. It felt to me like people who, you know, were sort of invested in the story and were like sort of playing with us. And that was really beautiful and cool, legitimately. My sort of storytelling background, I started as a kid doing LARPing in upstate New York at a camp called the Wayfinder Experience. So like the basis of my interest in narrative like comes from this kind of thing. And like the people who were playing along with the characters, it was like super beautiful and cool. Then there were people who were playing along but being like, this sucks, this is fake, I want to ruin it. Then there were people who like thought they were detectives, who were like, clearly this isn't real. It's definitely, you know, a real model who's doing this for attention. Very few people were like, this is a startup that has 40 employees. But when I say it showed me the limitations, this was at a time where it was when Quibi was getting going and Hollywood, there was like this obsession with like, oh, everyone wants like short form content. And the problem is you can't tell a cogent, not centralized story to people in the Philippines and New York and Quebec at the same time. It taught me that internet storytelling was not going to take over Hollywood. And I truly believe that it's not. I think that there are interesting things happening on social media with narrative stuff, but we were really in the belly of the beast of like trying to do something high level interesting and sort of creating levels of story engagement. So it was really fascinating for a while, that element of it. And it just kind of came undone as a result of being a VC backed startup, which is they don't want you to do anything that is interesting or takes that amount of time.
Right. One connecting point that I'm detecting, I think, between your, was it called Brud? Was the
Brud. Brud. B-R-U-D. Yeah. Great name.
Yeah, great name. Between Brud and your play Job, specifically the character of Jane, is that in your role as storyteller and then sometime content moderator, you're the connection point between the VC's dreams of scalable entertainment and vast riches and the consumers of this narrative content. And it seems like you must have been really stretched, because here you have the clueless investors who are talking about Jesus and Muhammad as influencers, who have no idea what narrative is really or if it's going to work online. You're trying to make it work both for their business model that they've set up, but also for this global audience that has a range of responses, and some of which are people taking this all too seriously. If that's right, then I noticed a similar kind of stretched out feeling in the character of Jane that maybe contributed to her mental break in the play.
I think that's a really apt, astute observation. I think the character in the play deals with a similar conundrum of what must be done and what is right, or what is there an obligation to do versus like, what does an individual sort of actually want? And I think that there's a lot to be said between that sort of moral conundrum and the relationship between like fandom and VCs, where both are incredibly invested in a property, but in radically different ways. I think our VCs, like when you're dealing with a firm that big, and I, you know, don't want to talk like I have any experience with this or like really know how it works, but it almost felt, it was like extreme investment, but also like profound indifference, because like they're not, they're taking a flyer on us. I mean, however much money they're putting in, $5 million, whatever, it's nothing to them. So they would sort of, it felt like they would glance at it every now and then and be like, oh, this isn't working, but like ultimately like didn't care. I mean, like they sort of let it go way longer than I would have expected.
As you said or alluded to earlier, there's no desire for quality or good storytelling in your case, or to create something meaningful or actually helpful for the audience or the consumer. Again, to return to this point, you have the business model, which is growth at any cost, exploit whoever you have to exploit. You know, let's just see if we can get even more rich. That's what the investors are saying. And then in the middle, you have, among other roles, you have content moderators who are trying to clean up the mess that the business model by design creates. This is what came up in my interview with Sarah T. Roberts, is that the content moderators are cleaning up this mess, that the scalable algorithmic amplification of Google and Facebook create by design. And so you have people like your character Jane and your play Job, who inevitably face mental health issues. What I found interesting in the character of Jane is that she did not come into the office. I don't think this is a spoiler. She doesn't come into this office complaining about the company. To the contrary,
she loves the company.
She loves it, and she's proud of the work she does, and she's intent on getting back in so that she can continue to help people, she says. She wants to help people. And she sees her work within the bowels of this horrible big tech behemoth, whichever one you want. She sees her role as a noble calling, and she has assigned her personal identity fully to this role as content moderator. Have you talked to content moderators who work within big tech? And is that a kind of attitude that you've seen in real life content moderators?
Yes and no. The initial impetus of the play, like the very spark of the idea, was I briefly met a content moderator in San Francisco when I was visiting a friend of mine from college. It was her roommate. She just seemed like she was having a really awful time. I've met subsequently a couple content moderators at shows, just sort of by accident, by fortune. That exact attitude has not been reflected to me. I think what Jane's attitude is more emblematic of is a way that I really sympathize with a lot of tech workers who I think have been fed a dream that is sort of impossible, where they're not by no means the most persecuted workers in the world. And they are not blue collar workers, but they also, I think I know so many people who worked for these big companies straight out of college because it was paying more than anyone else. And the bigger ones are such behemoths that your relationship with your work is really strange, where it feels like through the sort of perks that exist and the yoga rooms and the bus and the food, it feels like they're individuating you in order to sort of separate you from the larger machine in which you operate. So I'm really obsessed and interested in this sort of collective trick that seems to be like a part of how a lot of big tech companies operate, which is making people feel, you know, like they're kind of working at the center of the universe. And so I think Jane's attitude, again, is sort of maybe the parts of the play that feel more like a parable, or more like we're trying to get at something about tech. But we've also talked to a number of people who come to the show who work at smaller places and have gotten laid off in the past year. We talked to a young guy who had been laid off twice in the last 6 months from different tech companies. So it's all, you know, sort of the buy and bust of it all, this sort of fast rise and fall that is incredibly attractive to people my age and younger in such uncertain times and in such an uncertain economy. So all that to say, I think that part of the success of the play, as strange as it is I think we're representing part of the labor force, a big part of the labor force that doesn't really see itself on stage that often, or that is also hopefully represented with both sympathy and empathy while also calling attention to, you know, the sort of hypocritical nature of some of the intrinsically hypocritical nature of parts of their work.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Max Friedlich, who's the playwright of a new play that's playing in Manhattan right now. It's called Job. It's playing at the Soho Playhouse to sold-out audiences. There is a link to the play on the playlist. If you go to WFMU.org, click playlist and comments, and there's a mailing list, and there are some suggestions there about how you can get on a list of people who can maybe get into the show day of. Max talks a little bit about that later in the interview. You can also go to the playlist to join in the live listener comments if you'd like. We have a good conversation going there. Let's go ahead and listen to the second half of my interview with Max Friedlich here on Tectonic on WFMU. Yeah, I think it's significant that we have an off-Broadway play that is selling out every night that features a big tech content moderator as one of the two characters. I mean, even an off-Broadway play that is questioning the ethics of big tech at all. I can't think of another play that has done this, certainly not one that is getting the attention that yours is deservedly getting. Have you heard from other people in tech about their reactions to the show, or what's the general reaction you're getting?
From the tech community, if we want to call it that, you know, the word community being one of the more overused words in our social lexicon, but the New York tech community has responded super positively and has been super supportive. And it's been great to talk to people after shows. I no longer go to every show now that we're open. And the thing that I miss the most is getting to talk to the tech people legitimately. Because again, there is this sort of representational element of people. It's just a huge swath of the modern workforce that just sort of doesn't get dramatized in this way. I'm like trying to be so careful not to like portray them as an oppressed class of people, because they're of course legitimately not. But yeah, the response has been super warm by and large. I'm also, you know, if there is negative stuff out there, I'm probably the last to hear about it. But yeah, it's been super surprising and interesting. And I legitimately loved having tech folks come up to me afterwards and share their experience. I talked to someone who worked on the bots that do a good amount of the content moderation at Google. Someone who was one of the original designers of those bots and those algorithms was at the show, and she had amazing insight and got to speak to our lead actress, Sydney. And so all that has been really cool. I mean, we're sort of making a play about them that is also sort of critical of that world. And it's been super gratifying to have those folks be like, yeah, I think there's something here that resonates for me, or there's some element of my experience that is being revealed here that I don't often get to see. So again, super humbling, super gratifying to hear from those people.
Is this your first play? You mentioned you're 26.
I was referring to myself in the past. I am 29 now.
You got old. Sorry. So at 29, this is a great start. I mean, it must be near your first.
I had a play, my first sort of any sort of semi-professional venture into playwriting was in 2012. I had a play at the New York Fringe Festival when I was 17. So I've been writing plays and trying to produce plays for the better part of 10 years. Not the better part of 10 years, a full 11 years. It is my first play on this scale, on this level. First play off Broadway, certainly the first play where I've had this caliber of actor and this caliber of collaborator and producing team and director and all of that. So in many ways, it is that funny thing of being very much a first thing and sort of a launching pad, and also something that is a decade in the making.
I just wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about the generational divide. Apart from all the big tech content moderator stuff, the difference between the generations and your two characters is the source of much of the play. As you said at the beginning, the psychotherapist, Lloyd, is a baby boomer, whereas Jane, the content moderator, is millennial. Listeners are probably familiar with the memes or the chatter online that millennials will say things about boomers. The phrase, okay, boomer, got popular a few years ago. One thing I liked about this interplay between these two characters is that they were both trying to tell the truth about the other's generation. I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but I appreciated how you're on the millennial side, and yet you were able to write the character of an ex-hippie boomer, really telling the millennial, not in such harsh words, but essentially what's wrong with your generation. How were you able to get both sides of that conversation?
I think it's just about, I mean, if there's an art form, I mean, that's sort of the nature of the art form, is you really have to believe or understand the different points of view. And in the case of sort of the intergenerational conversation that happens in the play, I happen to agree with, you know, I don't like to tip my hand too much in terms of like what I actually think, but I think a lot of the points made in either direction in the play are things that I really agree with. I mean, I think it's encapsulated. In the play, they talk about the issue of affordable housing in San Francisco. Jane raises that it was old hippies who are sort of obsessed with aesthetics and, you know, want to keep the row houses in San Francisco looking pretty and pristine, really, you know, limiting housing laws that make it hard for people to build new affordable housing. At the same time, it's the tech workers, the people in Jane's generation, who are coming in and, you know, are the sort of boots on the ground gentrifiers of San Francisco. And so that is just a legitimately interesting gray area debate to me of who is at fault in these situations, and are we just pitting different groups against each other who both legitimately just want to live in nice neighborhoods and have their kids go to nice schools and not be kicking anybody out or doing any harm? Are we pitting these groups against each other that sort of want the same things in favor of big real estate, big tech, all of these bigger forces that govern our world? So I think it was about trying to find places in both directions where I was like, I see that point, and trying to address issues that I don't necessarily have the answers on, because I think that that is dramatically interesting.
It was interesting, and I think you did the right thing by having those two characters expose those tensions in their conversation. But as for who has the answers, I don't know. If you want to do a revision of the play at some point, you need to add a third character. You could always add someone from Gen X. I'm just saying, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Because boomers and millennials have been going at it and going at it for 5 to 10 years now. And those of us in the completely overlooked generation of Gen X have been sitting here the whole time saying, we know how to moderate this discussion. And no one ever asked for our opinion. Sorry, I'm going on a little rant right now. I'm just saying, if you've got to have somebody to give you the way forward, just look for somebody who was born right in the very trough, that demographic trough of Gen X, somebody born in 1972. I'm just saying, I don't have any particular suggestions, but just anybody who might be talking to you right now from 72.
Yeah, we could change the setting of the play to like a Modest Mouse concert and get some of that in there.
Or just have a Gen Xer pop his head in once in a while and just go, oh, whatever, and just leave.
Great. I'm sold. I'm on board. revision or sequel. I'm on board either way.
Actually, I thought you could do a sequel. This play is called Job, and I thought next time you could do a play about Apple and call it Jobs.
Oh, Jobs.
Yeah.
There you go.
You know, like Aliens.
Is that what the Alien sequel was called? Was it Aliens?
Yes.
Wow, that's awesome.
Apparently, that's James Cameron, he made the pitch by going to the whiteboard and writing Alien. And then he said, here's what we're going to do. And he put a dollar sign at the end of it.
Come on. Come on, Jimmy. Love it. That's awesome. That's one of the cooler. That's one of the cooler things I've heard in a really long time. Yeah, I would love to make jobs.
Well, Max, let's talk about how people can get to Job. As I said before, it's playing at Soho Playhouse in downtown Manhattan. How can people go online and see whether there are any tickets left for upcoming performances, and how long is the show going to be on for?
Right now, as of the time of our recording, we're extended to October 15th, but we're going to hopefully add some shows after that. We are Job the Play on Instagram and job@soho.co on the internet. On both of those places, you can sign up for our mailing list, which will be the easiest way to learn about new shows. Also on there is our ticketing policy. We now have like a standby line policy. We've had there's pretty decent luck if people show up for our 7 o'clock curtain at around 5:45, 6 and put their names down. We usually get, 5 to 10 people in every night that way. So there are definitely ways to see the show, even when tickets sell out. We still have tickets on TodayTix and Rush tickets and things like that. And all that information is on our website and our Instagram.
I don't want to jump the gun here, but what's the process for an off-Broadway show that does really well to become a Broadway show?
That is a great question. I don't know if that is the ultimate goal for me personally. I've really relished in and enjoyed the success that comes with being independent, which allows us to have a lower price point. I think it also makes the show feel like something people discover and feel like they have there's sort of like an internet commerce thing to that. It's like, I hope the show can feel like how I felt like finding new music on, freemixtapes.com and like datpiff.com, or finding new streetwear at like weird places in the Lower East Side, where you're like, you're finding this thing that isn't like individual to you, but like you kind of feel like, oh, like not everyone knows about this yet. So like, I really enjoy being independent, at least with this production. I think it's a really intimate show. I think smaller houses inform the show in a nice way. And we've had some videos about the show blow up on TikTok. And as a result, we have a lot of kids seeing the show. We have people who comment to us that this is like their first play. So all of that is really special and has been really wonderful. And as an art maker, all you sort of hope for is the maximum number of people seeing your thing. So I don't know if that's, I would love to find another home for it in New York. I would love for it to have a regional life of some kind. All of that would be really special, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I think that I've loved the discussion that the show has prompted, and I just want to share it with as many people as possible. The process of becoming a Broadway show, on its most base level that I can answer that, is we ran this show as a nonprofit, and we would need to transition the show to being a for-profit show. So we would need for-profit producers and people who really, see this as a way to make money. This show was funded by tax deductible donations. So that is the major transition. I don't know. I mean, it feels really wild to even like be able to have the tip of that conversation with a straight face. But I think we're all just trying to relish the moment, knowing that, our whole team was there a month ago when we were like painting the floors and sealing ourselves, and like all of our set is beautiful, an amazing sort of concise set design by our set designer, Scott Penner. But, we did not have a lot of money. That set costs like, I won't say how much, but not that much money. And so to go from that to all the strength of our performers and the strength of our design team to do what we've been able to do with the resources we have is really special. And I sort of, my nearest instinct is to sort of honor that. And if we can do it one level above and hopefully work with the same designers and give them just a little bit more fodder to execute their brilliance. They were able to do what they did here with so little. I would love to be able to see what they do with a little bit more, but to take it to Broadway, I think would be a sort of uncharted territory. And it's kind of hard for me to picture, to be honest. I wouldn't say no, by the way, to anyone, to all the Broadway money heads, to all the tech barons who hate listen to this program. We will accept. I'm open to it. Let's talk, baby. Let's talk. Let's cut a deal.
I've heard that if you get a for-profit team of investors and producers, what is really helpful is if you get a virtual avatar to be an influencer.
Yes.
For the play.
100%.
And that just brings it full circle.
I did want to, my friend Cody Victor, who's an amazing filmmaker who helped me make TikToks for the show, they're 19 years old. And I did have this idea, this like high-minded idea where like I would just have them be me and like have like a much hipper, cooler version of myself. So I did want to, I actually, my first instinct in marketing the show was I did want to make a real life flesh avatar of myself. Off of my friend Cody.
A flesh avatar. That's the new idea. That's going to be 2024. Forget AI. It's flesh avatars.
Flesh avatars, baby. Get in on the ground floor. Again, I'm available. I'm taking meetings. Flesh avatar. Let's do it to the moon.
Well, Max Friedlich, I really want to congratulate you on your success.
And thank you so
I'm
much.
I'm really looking forward to seeing your future successes roll out, because I know there's going to be many of them. And I hope you'll come back to the show sometime. Friends, go see the play Job at Soho Playhouse. And Max, thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic on WFMU. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 16 minutes of the show. And then the great Dave Mandel comes in with his show called It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. And then Band Animals with Jim the Poet and Amanda. And then Brother Daniel Blumen takes us on to midnight, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern Time. So a lot of good listening coming ahead. I want to say thanks again to Max Friedlich for his time talking to me about his play Job. What a talent, right? At age 29, to have accomplished this already. I'm serious. I'm looking forward to hearing what he does next. And if it has anything to do with tech, hope he'll be back on the show. Again, you can find the link to the website with information about the play at the playlist, wfmu.org, click playlists and comments. And if you're listening in the future, go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and find the October 2nd, 2023 show and click the playlist link. And depending on how far in the future you are and what happens with the play, maybe it's still running, you know, in the year 2025, and Job just keeps running and running. It's like the new Fantastics. And you can see what the ticket policy is in that year. Anyway, I'm really glad that Max was on the show and I could share with you some of the experience of going to the play, which, as I said, was thought-provoking and brings to light a part of the tech industry that deserves to get more attention. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about content moderation and maybe one or two of the links that I've put on the playlist. But first, before I forget, and before we run out of time, I want to say something about this October fundraiser that we've got going on at WFMU. It's called the Hellraiser. We do this every year for the month of October. And what we're encouraging people to do is just pitch in a little bit, because this is how we fund, this is how we get funds for the rest of the year, the operation for the radio station for the balance of the calendar year. You know, we have a spring fundraising marathon, and that's super important, and we get a lot of funding. And then when it comes around to October, things always look a little bit lean, and we just want to make a quick invitation for listeners and supporters who love this station to pitch in a little bit. And here's how you do it. You go to WFMU.org, and there is what we call Pledge Widget, the dog and the cow. You just click on them, and you put in some amount, and then you get to choose the swag that you want. I mean, it's a great deal, actually. There are two T-shirts that you can get just for this October fundraiser. One of them is the Get Hooked T-shirt by Love and Victory, and the other one is the Cycloptopus T-shirt by Kaz, which actually was originally designed in the 1980s, and now it's back, and this is the first time the station has done it as a T-shirt. So you can put in 100 clams and get both of the T-shirts plus a DJ Premium, and if I could recommend a DJ Premium, it would be the album that Scott Williams and I put together for you called A Simple Desultory Tectonic, which the first four songs of are our take on Simon and Garfunkel, except we rewrote the lyrics to be all about surveillance. And then there's a bunch, I think 12 other songs to round out the album. They're all surveillance-related songs that I've played on past shows. So if you put in $100, make sure to click the one DJ Premium checkbox so that you can get, this is your last chance, as far as I know, to get my album from this year. So yeah, we're trying to raise $340,000, and we're going to do it pledge by pledge by pledge. As always, we rely on you, the listeners. You don't hear advertising, you don't hear us taking underwriting breaks. We just come on in October with a little brief invitation for you to do this. So thanks in advance for doing that. And everyone who's part of our monthly donor program called Swag for Life, thank you for continuing to support us in every month. Really, really appreciate it. So that's my pitch for Hellraiser. Hope to see my pledge count go up a little bit. It's at 4 right now. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about that. I want to say something about content moderators before I got to clear out of here and Dave Mandel comes in. Boz from the Netherlands, a longtime listener. Thank you, Boz. And a longtime supporter of WFMU, wrote on the comment board during Max Friedlich's interview, what is a content moderator? And I'm so glad he asked, because now that I think about it, I don't think Max or I ever gave a summary description of what that job role is about. There is a link on the playlist to my interview a few years ago with Sarah T. Roberts, and we get into much more detail. There's a whole interview about content moderators from September 16, 2019. It's the link's on the playlist. You can listen to that. But just as a brief summary, big tech companies are dealing with tons and tons of content that gets generated. In the case of a company like Facebook or Google, in particular YouTube, they have user-generated content. People are uploading a bunch of stuff. I mean, just unbelievable amounts of stuff all the time are being uploaded, and it gets posted right away after going through just a lightning-quick check, usually by an algorithm. And if the algorithm is not sure whether to take it down, they'll send it over to a human moderator, and then the human moderator has to decide whether to take it down. This is, as far as I understand, this is after the content is already up. So things get flagged for content. And what that ends up meaning is that human moderators have to, they are forced, I mean, this is their job, they're forced to watch the absolute worst kinds of video content that you can possibly imagine. It's probably worse than that. It's probably worse than you can possibly imagine is what they have to watch day in and day out. So I have this, I have a couple of stories from The Guardian just from August, just from a few weeks ago. There's this Kenyan group of moderators that are employed by a company called Sama. Sama is a Californian company that subcontracts to companies like Facebook to bring in human moderators from all over the world to view this horrible content. And there are moderators that are now alleging, which I completely believe, that they're suffering mental health issues because they have to watch this horrible stuff. They're being paid very, very little, and there's little to no mental health care on site. So from August 16, there's a story in The Guardian that I'll just read you this one paragraph. Daniel Motong, who was hired as a Facebook content moderator by Summit in 2019, and this is Mr. Motong lives and works in Kenya, in Nairobi, I believe. So Motong was hired as a Facebook content moderator in 2019, filed a lawsuit against both companies, both Facebook and Sama, alleging that he had been exposed to graphic and traumatic content without adequate prior knowledge or proper psychosocial support, which he said left him with post-traumatic stress disorder. There's another article from August in The Guardian. Moderators also working for Sama, and this is a contract with OpenAI, which is Sam Altman's company that makes ChatGPT. That's one where the content is it's not being immediately uploaded by users, but it's the ChatGPT language model that's just hoovering up all kinds of horrible garbage all over the internet to churn up into its little text extrusion engine that I've talked about in past shows. This is the Guardian article. The 51 moderators in Nairobi working on Sama's OpenAI account were tasked with reviewing texts and some images, many depicting graphic scenes of violence, self-harm, murder, rape, necrophilia, child abuse, bestiality, and incest, the petitioners say. And so you can imagine, and this is just 51 moderators in Nairobi, you have to multiply that by some unimaginably large number to get to wrap your arms around the scale of this problem, how many moderators there are, often in countries that may, you know, may be low cost. And so the moderators are being paid very little. These moderators in Nairobi are saying they were paid between $1.46 and $3.74 an hour to watch all of those horrible, horrible scenes. And Facebook's response was basically, hey, it's not our problem. They work for Sama, not us, which is their strategy, of course, is to push the problem, push the externalities onto vulnerable communities all over the world, outside the headquarters of Facebook. Let someone else deal with it. And as I brought up to Max, the entire Facebook business model, the entire YouTube business model, the entire OpenAI business model requires enough content to make these models and the algorithms work. That really, they depend on this horrible information, these horrible scenes, so that they can get at occasionally something that is not awful. And the only way for these companies to survive at all, to make their margins and to achieve their growth at any cost, is to exploit these laborers in these vulnerable places all over the world. So it's completely rotten and unethical and disgusting. And that is what this play job is touching on, is the reality of lives and workplaces all over the world that are hidden from us by design, by these toxic, unethical companies. And look, that's about all the time I have for this evening, but thanks for sticking with me. And I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel and It's Complicated. By the way, we're going to go out this evening, not to a song, but to something that is spoken word I thought it'd be fun to hear from Lil Miquela, this this AI influencer was from Brud, I guess. It's not marked as coming from Brud. It's just coming from Lil Miquela. And this is one of the characters that Max's team worked on a few years ago. And it is still going strong, I guess, getting all the followers that he mentioned. So we're going to hear Lil Miquela giving a highlight of 2021. It's from a couple of years ago, the top 10 things, something like that. I want to remind you, you're listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, you know what to do. Avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google And I'll see you next time, friends. Have a good week.
On this week's episode of My Life is in Shambles, Sci-Fi Edition,
I'm bringing you the top 10 moments from 2021, as chosen by a robot. Me, I'm the robot. So this year I turned 19, for the sixth time to be exact. Yes, I'm a robot, and no, I don't age, so birthdays are always kind of whatever. So for my birthday, my team at Bread gifted me a USB drive necklace loaded with all of my program memories. The keyword there is programmed. Literally changed my entire life. Have you ever been presented a USB necklace containing all of your past memories on it? That's right, my baby photo, high school boyfriend, my emo phase, they were all fake, just part of my code.
Everything's weird, but around here, we call that normal.
Also on that USB drive, a mysterious upgrade to my programming. The last time I got an upgrade, my whole face changed, so naturally I was so effing scared to install it. This time when I upgraded my programming, I got powers? Not in a magic kind of way, but I can control electricity. Well, kind of. Sometimes. I haven't quite gotten the hang of it, but something crazy is happening. My eyes are basically mood rings now. They're red when I'm angry, and purple when I'm, well, you know.
Do I know what's going on?
No.
But that's never stopped me before.
Quick pop culture break. Our fave Queen Taylor took petty to another level with a short film about a breakup. I've never felt so seen. I know a thing or two about obsessing over past relationships. I do it daily. I did it in a whole music video. Twice. Also, Jake, give that girl back her scarf. Squid Game. Duh. I watched the whole thing. Twice. Holler at me, Player 67. I love you. We did it, y'all. Britney is finally free. And while some people were silent, ahem, Xtina.
Hashtag free Britney.
All of her fans really came through for our girl, and now it looks like she's thriving. If I ever get hacked or something, y'all will come free me too, right? Speaking of freedom, linking IRL was kind of tough this year. But when we did get to hang IRL, it was iconic. I mean, the hottest teenage witch in Captain Marvel Jr. Also, I got to meet Ariana Grande. She was a lot quieter than I imagined, but her ponytail was everything. I have a confession. Without y'all, I'd literally be glitching. Every time you voted to help me make a decision, like picking an outfit or deciding to reveal my crush, you were programming me. I don't know where I'd be without my community, so keep voting or my hardware might malfunction. So naturally, I released a series of NFTs way before all the bros caught on. I got to give out artwork to all of you new collectors and friends for free. I've been in the metaverse, sweetie. Do I have a crush? That's my business. But the answer is yes. You might know him as my friend boy. More on that to come, I'm sure. It's new and it's confusing, so like, drop all your advice to new romance below. I'm clueless. Thanks for wrapping up 2021 with me. I'm so glad we made it through together. Stay tuned and remember to keep voting. This bot girl needs help navigating your world. And don't forget to recharge your hearts.
That's the magical signal. It's time for another episode of It's Complicated. This show comes to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m. I'm Dave Mandel, the host of this show, where we bring you a so-called hour of so-called prog and prog-adjacent music. Thanks for joining me this week. We're going to begin tonight's show with something from, I was going to say an obscurity. You sophisticated FMU listeners, to you sophisticated FMU listeners, it won't probably be quite as obscure. But this is a release. We're going to hear a track from a release by the Peter Ivers Band. And this was a extreme, you know, unknown, obscure rarity and was rediscovered, probably reissued a while back, and now it's not quite so unknown, but still a great record. Peter Ivers was a musician based most of his career in L.A. and had some fairly big fame. Is that, is that grammatically weird? He did the music for Eraserhead. He hosted a TV show called New Wave Theater. I guess it was like a cable show or something called New Wave Theater. But he had a group, and his music varied a lot over the years. Like, some of his later records are much more pop and less remarkable, in my opinion. But we're going to hear a track from a sort of legendary album released by the Peter Ivers Band in 1969 called Night of the Blue Communion. I should also mention the most interesting and saddest fact about Peter Ivers is that he was murdered at a pretty young age in Los Angeles in, I think, 1983, and the murderer was never found. The murder was never solved, so that's sad, unfortunate, obviously. We're going to hear a track from the Peter Ivers Band. Again, Night of the Blue Communion, 1969. This will be a track called Dark Illumination, sort of on the brink, as we often are on this program, between psych and Prague, Peter Ivers Band. Thank you. And that's something from the Peter Ivers Band, 1969. That album should be, you know, more or less findable these days in whatever your preferred format is. Peter Ivers Band. We're going to go on to something kind of, sort of, in the same vein, from a French group called Fille qui mousse, like girl who foams up. Is that, would that be the correct English translation? Girl who foams, Fille qui mousse. They were a French band based in Paris. They put out only one record, which, again, same situation, pretty obscure group that probably will not be obscure to you sophisticates listening to this radio station, but really good group. And they were, fun fact, they were really, really pretty unknown until they appeared on the so-called Nurse with Wound list, which I won't just Google it. I won't go into detail what that is. But they were one of the obscure artists featured on that list, and I think that probably helped bring them to the attention of most of the world. So we're going to hear a track from the one album they released, again,